Well, it's very nice to be back. thank you for your patience. I had a wonderful time.
You went to the Sierras?
Yes. Yes, I went up to the Carson Pass area on Highway 88 and stayed at a little lodge up there on Silver Lake.
Anywhere by those fires?
It was another mountain over. So from where I was, you could see the smoke coming up from behind the mountains. There's a whole range of mountains, but you could see the smoke. It was very scary, and you could smell it. Yeah. But it was beautiful where I was, all wildflowers and long trails going back into the woods and over the passes and huge boulders and scoured granite. You know, the High Sierra is just fabulous. And there were lots of trails. The Pacific Crest Trail goes through there. So I took that a couple of times in different places. And took my little camera and took a lot of flower pictures. And hardly talked to anybody. it's lovely. It's also lovely to be back. We're on the eighth chapter of this book, No Time to Lose by Pema Chodron. It's called Meditative Concentration. Although it actually has a whole lot less to do with meditative concentration than one would have thought. I did a few notes that might be helpful. Thank you. So this 2,000-year-old poem study of the mind of practice, you could say, or the mind of bodhisattva practice, is in three different sections. The first three chapters are about generating bodhicitta, generating the mind of enlightenment, actually even beginning to consider that there is such a thing, and then to begin to develop it. It means noticing that there are other people around, for one thing, beginning to notice that maybe one isn't always the center of the universe, and beginning to wonder why and what this is anyway. And then from there to begin to develop various ways of encountering the world through the paramitas. Then the second three set is how to develop bodhicitta, how to make it stronger and better. And then the last set, the patience and meditative concentration and wisdom are the three that are to maintain and sustain this state, this determination and attitude. So last week, Donna Lynn talked about the patient side of it, and she said there wasn't much time for discussion. She had so much to say that she was a little sorry that she didn't leave time for discussion, so I thought I would open it up tonight for that first, if there is anything about that to carry over to tonight.
I thought she talked about enthusiasm.
Oh, yes, she did. I take it back. It is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Which is the same as vigor.
Yes.
Yes. Thanks, Wendy. Yeah. So, is there anything left over from that?
No, not
in my mind. No. Good. Good. Yes, patience is one of the ones in the second three, isn't it? Well, this is a very curious chapter, and one of the ones that is the most monkish, it's when you realize that it's a monk who's expressing himself in this way. And so it's relevant. Pema Chodron makes it relevant by the way that she kind of slides over some of the most monkish things and kind of lifts it out of the almost puritanical finger shaking. You know, there's a whole riff on lust and all the ways of dealing with lust, mostly by seeing how rotten and miserable and horrible the body really is. If you really look at it and all the icky stuff that's going on, then you won't feel lustful anymore. Of course, you know, if you've taken a vow of celibacy, you have to have some kind of techniques for dealing with that. I know Ajahn Amaro, the Theravadan monk who lives, is always teaching around here, and has taken that vow, has a lot to say about it also. It's one of the biggest challenges. So that shows up big time in this chapter with Shantideva. And about how to relate in terms of loving people, of connecting with people. And in a monastic situation, you've tried to give that up for a sort of deeper and wider connection with everything. I've always had my doubts about it. Having known, closely known some people who've lived in a monastic situation for a long time. And from what I know, it turns out to be just like life. That you end up sitting with somebody you really don't like, and you have to sit with her for the rest of your life if you're a certain kind of nun. Or you have to deal with people who are extremely difficult and self-centered and etc. And your whole, all your own stuff is all involved with it too. We call it practice and come together and work together on our life and ourselves, but most of our life and practice is in the so-called world. So, it's not the same as Shantideva's life, or even Pema Chodron's life, who is a consecrated nun also. I think our effort to practice as we're doing here is so precious and so important. We don't have to wear something special or consider ourselves something special. We simply show up wherever we are. And in the end, the kind of mind that Shantideva is pointing to, the mind that sees through the kind of wildness of our mind and body, sees as we are, and are willing to tame it. We're all working on ourselves. And his basic point is that we're always trying to be special and forgetting how ephemeral life really is. So in the end, he's reminding himself. It's a kind of dialogue with himself. Well, it's temporary. The whole thing is so temporary. And it's uncontrollable, really. So, he says, go away and sit. Take a break and sit. If you're overwhelmed by the things of life, the best thing to do, not to try to solve it, but to withdraw. And just be quiet for a while. So that's why this is called the Meditative Concentration Chapter, for all that he goes into the various problems, the challenges, and he keeps coming back to meditation. And that's our essence also, that for all the kind of life in the world that we do and have and be, that we keep coming back. Over and over. We know where that quiet place is. We know how to come back to it. Sometimes it's not easy, but we're informed. So, what I put as the second half of this is, since he talked about shamatha and vipassana, and Pema did too in her book, I thought I would just give you a kind of short and sweet description of what that is. It's the vipassana way of talking about zazen. It's set up in a different way, so the practice appears differently, but the result, the end result, is the same. So they start out with the mindfulness practices, especially mindfulness of breathing, and then mindfulness of the thoughts that are passing, and the mindfulness of everything. You could probably tell about this better than I can. You've done it, haven't you, Anho?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all about, yeah, exactly, mindfulness of everything. Everything is an object of meditation.
Yes.
Birds singing or
yes.
Stomach churning or whatever. Everything can be an object, being pain in your back or whatever.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So that's one wing. They talk about it as if it were a bird, meditation were a bird, and one wing is shamatha. And then the other one is vipassana, which is developing insight. Insight is a very big deal. In fact, it's called insight meditation in Redwood City. It's kind of the basis of vipassana practice is mindfully seeing how things are through impermanence and insubstantiality and no self. seeing through. So that's the other wing. So both wings make the meditation bird fly. In our practice, in Zazen practice, we just sit down without esteem. And these things happen. They just do happen. Our only instruction is just to be awake and just to be present. So presence means everything that's happening, just like shamatha. And as we sit, we begin to pass through the various stages of shamatha. And in Vipassana practice, they make a big study of the stages of practice, but in my experience, if we sit long enough, we naturally pass through them all. It's just like how food gets digested. You don't have to think about it or make it happen. It just happens. And so in the beginning, there's a kind of calmness that begins to happen, even though the mind is going on and on and on. So we begin to quiet down, just naturally quiet down. And then eventually a kind of happiness comes along with it. And then little by little things develop, and it becomes, there are a number of different stages, but mostly it's, you end up with an equanimous mind, a balanced mind, not wigged out in some kind of spacey way, and not special in any way, but just evenly present and completely there, here, as it is. Well, I made a lot of notes, but one of his big points is to exchange self and other, which is a Tibetan practice. We don't do that so directly in Zen, but it certainly is a part of our insight, our understanding, that self and other are simply the same. And so in the Tibetan practice, the Tonglen practice of exchanging self and other, or the Vipassana practice of metta, where you extend loving kindness first to yourself and then to your loved ones and then to people you don't know and then to people you know and you don't like, mm-hmm. and then everybody else. And by that time, you know, you're huge. And then in order to end it, you bring it back so that you end up having extended it and brought it back all the way to yourself again, with the understanding that it's not about obliterating ourself. It's not trying to be nobody, but to see that everyone is included when we say I. It's all of us. So maybe that's enough. He says in there, cherish others as I love myself, which is just the same message that every single great teacher has ever said. But we haven't been saying it very long, just a few thousand years. So it hasn't gone on long enough for us to get it together. We can see it, we can try it, but it hasn't quite happened yet. But that's the Bodhisattva vow. That's what saving all beings means. Thank you. So are there questions?
What's the meaning of this last line, heart brave with samsara?
That's what Pema calls it. Oh. Life in samsara is heartbreak.
Oh, okay.
So, and the heartbreak drives us to sit. And it also drives us to see how unappetizing it really is, or something like that. It was very strange to read that this afternoon because I had such a wonderful week last week. I thought, well, but really, sometimes a little pleasure is a good thing. So, but from a monkish point of view, you really have to look hard at it and be willing to step aside, you know, to put all that away. And as I say, that's very strict. And I don't feel very strict, so. But that's what she called it. She also called it dissolving the barriers, which is more like meditation practice. You know, that's a nice way of thinking of meditation, that it's dissolving the barriers that we just sort of unconsciously set up between ourself and everything else. So, and
it's that notion of having an expansive mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think there was that distinction then. There were other schools. I'm so bad about this. I never remember the schools and what they stand for. There were a number of them by then, because it was after the turn of that first century, after Buddha died, I mean the mm-hmm. millennium.
So he predates Theravada.
I would think so, in the way that it comes to us now. No, I can't say so. No, because the Theravada is really the essential basic teachings of Buddha himself. So they go back to the old sutras. The mindfulness practice is based on the Satipatthana Sutra, which is the mindfulness sutra that came from Buddha's own words. So, no, it's the other way around. But by the time of Shantideva, it's been elaborated so that it sounds, at least from the way that Pema has presented it, as much Vajrayana as Theravada. Sorry, I don't know more about it. But I don't.
So in Zen, I did have the pleasure of hearing Ajahn Mara a couple of weekends ago. This is INC conversation between him and Zen.
Joe Barbaro.
Yeah. Dueling duality. That was the topic, dualism. So, and Joseph he had a strange statement. He said he doesn't start his students out with shikantaza. So what does he start out with? Just
probably mindfulness.
Sorry, what was that word, and what does that mean?
Shikantaza is a word that's often used to describe the meditation that we do in Zen, which means upright sitting or hitting the target sitting or tied down conduit sitting. Some way of describing how this is this way as well as this way, and how it all takes place right now, right here, right now. It's not just ordinary sitting and breathing kind of zazen either. It's the one that is completely mind and body just thrown away into it. So I don't think anybody actually starts out teaching shikantaza. You usually start out teaching how to sit and be comfortable on the cushion, and how to be upright. And the sitting, the upright position already is our best teacher. It's what brings the whole thing into focus. So there's a big emphasis on that, especially in the beginning, to help people adjust and become familiar and comfortable with the body, their own body. Because often, especially the many people who've been so educated and so busy, we're in our heads most of the time. So to actually come and sit down on the ground and be a body is a kind of radical experience. And it takes some getting used to. If you go to Sesshin the first couple of days, you feel like you're going to jump out of your body. It just doesn't seem right to be staying in one place and just letting it be. But gradually, you begin to feel how it wants to be, and you begin to feel that you and it are the same. It all begins to kind of turn around so that you have a much deeper and more earthy sense of yourself and your life.
And is that where shikantaza begins, or is it going to achieve that, or?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, the implication that people teach this assumes that you can learn.
I don't think you can teach it.
Oh.
I think you can help people with their comporting themselves, and you can talk about what the mind does somewhat to encourage people not to freak out because their minds are spinning so hard. But then it's up to each one of us. We just, and the best part of it is that we can trust ourselves and trust the process, that it's a completely natural process. It's actually the process of our life as we live it. And in zazen, we learn to abandon ourselves to it and completely trust it. So it's a wonderful thing. Well, it's 8:00. Pema does not have a chapter on the 9th chapter of this. She says it's so complicated that it takes a whole book. Dalai Lama has written a whole book about it. There are several scholars who have written about it, and I thought I'd look at the Dalai Lama's book for next week and see what happens. I don't. It's about wisdom, about prajna, which is what we meet every time we chant the Heart Sutra. It lifts the prajna right up, and that's where we are. So it's an important subject, and if we, maybe Shantideva was refuting many different schools of thought, and so that most of his chapter is about those refutations, and it's very esoteric for us. But I will try to talk about prajna some next week in a more homely way. And and then we'll be finished with this subject. So I implore you to think about something else. Apparently we haven't chosen anything beyond this, so we need to. So think about it, and I'll think about it too. And then we can talk about that again. I wanted to tell you also that I heard from Beth, and she's coming to us on the 2nd of October. So she's coming back. Beth is a Zen nun who is working with Cambodian AIDS people in the slums of Phnom Penh, and she comes once a year and inspires us.